joining you from Cuba. I'm talking on my cell phone. I'm delighted that my dear friend and colleague Tom Jelton is hosting the podcast this week. Tom, it's so good to be with you.
And it's so good to be with you, Diana.
Thank you. And on my mind this week, Tom, I gather you'll be talking with a professor at the U.S. Naval War College on how America lost faith in expertise. And Tom, once again, thank you so much for hosting. I'll turn the mic over to you from here.
Well, first of all, Diane, tell us where you are today.
We are in Juventud, in the western part of Cuba. And with me is a brilliant young man. Ooh. His name is David Garcia Martin, who has been our guide. So, Tom, roll away with your question.
Well, David, great to have you part of this conversation. You've been in Cuba for a few days now. Tell us a little bit about where you've been, what you've seen, what your impressions are.
Well, Tom, my personal impressions are of the people who have an extremely divided population, as we do in the United States. There are many people here in beautiful neighborhoods, in beautiful homes. Then there are those who live on the outskirts with very little. Even the animals seem to be without sufficient food, even though there is, what David has explained to us, a ration book that each Cuban gets. Each child up to the age of 7 gets a certain amount of milk and dairy and meat and other products. But once the child turns 7, those supplies diminish considerably. So people like David, who has been trained in 4 languages, has to both teach and supplement his income by serving as a guide. But I repeat, the difference between those who have and those who have not seems quite wide. David, would you agree?
I would say there is a huge difference, but I would say we have a gigantic middle class in Cuba. So people just have a job and make a living. Some people are, of course, rich. You know, we've been to some very nice private-owned restaurants, and those people are making money, but they're paying taxes. They're working hard from 6:30 a.m. to 1 o'clock a.m., so they deserve to have money. I don't have a bad job. I have a good job. It's well paid, and I spent 8 years studying in 2 universities. I studied 5 foreign languages. I worked in 4, so I think I deserve it. The thing about Cuba is that we all have the same rights and opportunities. That's what I was talking to the group about yesterday, and about what people do, what each individual does with those opportunities is up to them.
I must say, Tom, and you may not know this, I was here in Cuba in 1977 when my husband, as a private attorney, was asked to come down here for a client to begin talking with Cuban authorities about the exchange of baseball for Cuba and the United States.
You said you were last there in 1977. Of course, that was during the time when Cuba was enjoying huge subsidies from the Soviet Union, all of which then disappeared. And it's been since the disappearance of those subsidies that Cuba has had such hard times. But I wanted to pursue something else, Diane and David, and that is what you noticed, Diane, about the inequality in Cuba. Did that come as a surprise to you, given that Cuba is a socialist country and, you know, one of the hallmarks of socialism is normally equality? Does the amount of inequality there surprise you, Diane?
It is the amount of inequality seems to me very, very different from what I saw in 1977. But mind you, we were taken by minders. I was taken to an absolutely pristine hospital. I saw doctors. I spoke with nurses. I spoke with patients, and then I was taken to school areas to speak with both teachers and young children who did speak English. So I was not exposed back then to the countryside, which we are now seeing, and where I believe that inequality of opportunity may exist. Now, David, you tell me about what you see as the difference between those who are living in the good areas of Havana and those who are living on the countryside.
When did it all begin? It all began in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Before, in the 1970s and the 1980s, I was telling you, ladies and gentlemen, from the good, you would just go and pay 21 Cuban pesos for a room at the National Hotel. So you would just have a regular job and have a good living, make a good living. It was enough back then. And after we lost our full economical support from the Soviet Union, that's when, you know, it was split into classes, different social classes. And now what do we have now? A huge middle class, as I was telling you. Of course, like in many countries in the world, there is a difference. In Havana, you have more opportunities. You have more buses to go to school. You have more buses to go to your workplace. Here in Isla de la Juventud, a small island southwest of Havana, it's not the same. You need to get two or three buses here and some trucks. So it all has to do with the infrastructure.
You're talking about transportation, and I know from my own experience in Cuba, that's a really big issue. I'm curious, Diane, what you have seen in terms of the travails that people have in getting to and from their places of work. I know that public transportation is a big, big issue for Cubans living their daily lives. Diane, I'm wondering, Dave, if you can talk about that. But Diane, what have you seen and what have you heard from ordinary Cubans about the difficulties of getting to and from work, for example?
Well, as David has explained to us as we have been touring around, at rush hours, the number of Cubans trying to get onto buses to travel from home to work or work to home, there are simply not enough buses left over from that supply of vehicles that used to be there to transport everyone back and forth. The other issue, Tom, is the condition of the roads. We have been traveling in large Chinese-made buses on roads that are barely, barely able to be traversed. In fact, on one side, on the right side of the road, the potholes are so bad that the buses are moving to the left side of the road, and the police are very concerned about that. But in order to miss those potholes, you've got to move in that direction. And the fact is, as we have talked, maintenance in this country is not catching up with demand. It's much slower. It will take time. And there has to be the incentive on the part of people who work for the government to begin to do that work and to do it well and to do it quickly. And what I've seen are slow-moving people who perhaps do not yet have the incentive that one would hope that they would have to make this country a better place.
You know, Diane, what you were saying about the slowness of the workers reminds me of the stories I used to hear when I used to live in Eastern Europe, which was just recovering from communism. And they used to say there, we pretend to work, you pretend to pay us. And it sounds like that sort of is a characteristic, perhaps, of life and work in Cuba as well, even now.
David, did you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I was just telling the group as well about the subject salary in Cuba. Yes, it is low. So we got a phenomenon called, we describe it as the upside-down pyramid. So the people with the most important jobs get less money from the people, let's say, in the service area. We got some private entrepreneurs, tourism workers, and other workers that have to do with service. They provide service and they charge money for that. Okay, they're not paid by their state-owned company. And in this case, yes, we have that huge problem. That is the main economic problem nowadays in Cuba. When that pyramid is back to where or how it belongs, then we'll be speaking about a different Cuba. But in order to do that, we will need to go over jump over all the obstacles that Cuba has, which were, of course, you know, one of the most important, that would be the U.S. embargo.
What would you say is the big lesson that you have learned from this so far? What is the dominant impression? What are you going to bring back in terms of what you have learned so far about Cuba on this trip?
The conclusion that I come to, but mind you, I'm going to be doing another week, at least another 10 days here in Cuba. So I may not have reached my conclusions as yet. But so far, I have seen a mix of very, very industrious, hardworking people on the one hand, and on the other hand, a group of people who are not yet ready to step up to the plate, that there is a sense of perhaps someone else will do it. And Tom, one thing we haven't talked about, but you talk about in your book on Bacardi and the growth of Cuba, is the fact that slavery in this country was innate, an innate part of the growth of this country, and Cuba was one of the last countries to let go of slavery. That hit me very, very hard. And as I conclude my visit here in Cuba, we'll be talking about your book and how Bacardi and the growth of Bacardi and the growth of Cuba came right along together.
Well, thank you very much for that, Diane. And in fact, one of the things that Americans don't necessarily realize about Cuban history is that when Cuba fought for independence from Spain, a huge part of that struggle was to free the slaves and to end slavery. That was a big part of that. Diane, it's been terrific to connect with you in Cuba. I'm so glad that you're there. As you know, Cuba is a country I feel strongly about. I have a lot of warm feelings for the people of Cuba. And my impressions of the Cuban people have been consistent with yours. I've always been impressed by how joyful and vivacious Cubans are, how irrepressible they are. And it thrills me that you are having a chance after all these years to go back in Cuba. It's been terrific talking to you this morning, Diane. Have a great rest of your trip in Cuba.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you, David. That was David Garcia Martin. He's guiding Diane and her group in Cuba. We should point out that tour guides like David are hired by the Cuban government. Now, a quick break.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. And now, via Skype from Newport, Rhode Island, Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. His new book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Tom Nichols, I should say Professor Tom Nichols, you are yourself an expert. Did you write this book because you were beginning to feel disrespected?
Well, no. And as I say in the book, you know, any professor or intellectual or policy expert who doesn't have a thick enough skin should probably get out of that business. I wrote it because I was concerned about the way the public relates to expertise, the way experts relate to the public, and the way that knowledge seems to be falling out of our public life as something that guides our actions and our personal as well as our political choices.
But how did you realize that? How did you decide that this was an issue that was so bothersome to you that you wanted to write about it? What was your experience?
Well, the first time this ever occurred to me was when I just entered professional life 30 years ago, when it struck me that if you said that you were an expert on something, people would say, well, I have some ideas, you know, I want to talk to you about this, no matter what the subject was. I accepted that as kind of a normal thing, especially on big issues, whether it's, you know, the Cold War or taxes or whatever. That's just people being engaged and asking questions. What struck me probably over the past 10 years or so was that people weren't just questioning experts. They were trying to replace experts. People would say to me, you're an expert on Russia? Let me explain Russia to you. You're an expert on nuclear weapons? Let me explain nuclear weapons to you. And that I found a really striking turn. It went, American culture, and I think this is happening in other nations as well, went from asking pointed questions or being skeptical, which I actually think is a virtue in our society, to something much more corrosive, which was saying, I know better no matter what the subject is. And I would say that that really came to the fore for me personally around the time of the Snowden business, probably about 4 years ago, when suddenly people that had never heard of the National Security Agency, who had really never thought about Russia, suddenly became instant experts on every aspect of this issue. And that's about the time I wrote the first piece on this.
The title of your excerpt in Foreign Affairs is How America Lost Faith in Expertise and Why That's a Giant Problem.
Right. And Americans are losing faith in expertise in part because they're bombarded with messages from political organizations, from the media, from each other, from places like Facebook and Twitter, that not only that experts don't know anything, but reaffirming to the average citizen that they really can be smarter than experts. I get asked the question very often. Well, you know, can't people just do their own research? Can't people just go on the internet or do a lot of reading and then they can become as smart as experts? And people are really put off when I simply shake my head and say, no, generally speaking, that's not possible. Not everybody is, you know, a Thomas Edison or a Bill Gates who can simply sit down and kind of think through a problem and become smarter than the experts. And it used to be, I think, that people accepted that answer. They'd say, look, I'm skeptical. I have, you know, questions. There are things I don't trust. But generally, I think people, you know, smarter than me know what they're doing. Today, it's a double-barreled problem that people say, not only do I think everybody is corrupt and ignorant and not good at their jobs, but I can do it better. And that's really a terrible synergy right there.
And you say that this loss of faith in expertise is Google-fueled and Wikipedia-based. You're suggesting that there's so much information out there on the Internet that people actually can delude themselves into thinking that they know as much as needs to be known or even more than experts know.
Absolutely. This is a terrible paradox that at a time when we have more information available to us than at any time in history, we are actually using that flood of information very poorly. And in some cases, and this has actually been something that's been researched, especially where children are concerned, that we can come away from using the internet or other mass information sources. We can come away from using those dumber than when we went in, because instead of finding good information that helps us learn about something, we're plowing our way through a lot of bad information. And then we come away from that experience with an illusion of knowledge. You not only know less about the subject, what you know is wrong, and you're now more resistant to learning anything new because you think you've done it already. So it's an extraordinarily dangerous phenomenon. I always liken it to, as a metaphor, to food. We've never had more access to food as a society in the 21st century. But of course, most of it is junk, which is why even though we have more access to food, we're also becoming more obese and diabetic because we're eating a lot of bad food and we're eating too much of it.
You know, Tom, this reminds me of a conversation I had with my primary physician. She told me that the worst thing that has come down the pike for her is WebMD, because now she's getting all these patients who are coming in and self-diagnosing, and she says it's actually made things worse.
Yes, doctors actually have an expression for this. They call it paging Dr. Google. They use it among themselves when a patient comes in and starts lecturing back to the doctor about what's really wrong with them. When the first piece about this issue came out, before I'd written the book, doctors became a huge constituency for writing the book. I had a surgeon who told me at one point, he said, you know, I've gotten to the point where I just want to put all the medications and the instruments on a tray and push it across the table and tell the patient, go ahead. You do it.
And of course, one of the big issues that you focus on in your book, The Death of Expertise, is the anti-vaxxer phenomenon. The growth in the number of people who don't believe in vaccination, despite what medical professionals say.
Despite the fact that we've eradicated smallpox, we've nearly eradicated polio, it's really an amazing thing. And I think the word I use in the book that I think rubs a lot of people the wrong way, but I've been standing by it because I think it's true. The word I keep using is narcissism. People aren't really better informed. What they are is more narcissistic, and they find that talking back to doctors or diplomats or journalists is empowering. It makes them feel as though they're taking control of their lives in a very chaotic and undisciplined world. Look, any of us who are parents, we don't like to see our children stuck with needles. I always say I don't even like taking my daughter to the dentist. I can't even watch a dentist work on my kid. But the fact of the matter is that sense of helplessness should not then lead you to say, therefore, I don't trust the advice of medical professionals. And interestingly enough, this is concentrated not among poor people, not among people who lack education. The anti-vaxxer nonsense is actually heavily concentrated among more affluent parents who have the luxury of saying, well, I'll send my child to a private school, or I will, you know, simply refuse this and find a doctor who will tell me what I want to hear. And it's really dangerous. I mean, we're going to end up with a serious pandemic on our hands at some point.
Well, Michelle Bachmann famously was a hero to some of those anti-vaxxers by suggesting that the HPV, the human papilloma virus, is not something that girls should be vaccinated against. And yet you point out that it's not just, conservatives like Michelle Bachmann who endorse this. In fact, there are a lot of liberals, far left liberals, that have signed on to the anti-vaxxer movement.
Right. It's a way for people to put that front and center as a proxy for other issues they're concerned about. You know, it was interesting that Bachmann chose a vaccine that had to do with a sexually transmitted disease, because, of course, this was kind of a conservative issue, as opposed to the anti-vaxxers who on the left who think that there's a corporate kind of evil lurking behind this to sell and make money and to hoodwink people. So these become kind of a second order effect of the thing you're most paranoid about or the thing you're most concerned about on an already existing political agenda. And that's why I point out always when we talk about this, confirmation bias, that is the willingness to only believe the things you already believe, is really kind of the strongest drug there is. And it's the hardest thing to fight among, even among experts, but certainly among lay people.
Tom, let's talk a little bit about why this has developed. You have a great quote in here from Richard Hofstadter, and that's not a modern quote, I assume. That comes from a long time ago, where he said that the complexity of modern life has steadily whittled away the functions the ordinary citizen can intelligently and comprehendingly perform for himself. The suggestion there is that we are actually more dependent on experts than we've ever been.
Yes, and Hofstadter actually wrote that over 50 years ago, a time that now people would look back at and say it was a simpler, slower, easier time. But even then, you know, if you were the World War II generation or before, the world of the 1960s would seem remarkably complicated and difficult to comprehend. And so as the world becomes more complicated, as things around you become more complex, you do rely on experts more and you resent it. I think people find that if they were really honest, and I think Hofstadter has a great line here that, you know, the average person, if they were really honest with themselves, would say that they don't even understand their toaster. I think that leads to a kind of resentment and a sense of loss of control. When you add in that problem of narcissism, where people say, not only don't I understand this, but I'm smart and I should be able to understand it, that can really breed a lot of anger and resentment. It's also important to point out as well that when things go wrong, people want to believe in very complicated explanations because it's more comforting than believing that the world is complicated and chaotic and random and sometimes cruel. So this is not a new phenomenon, but it's certainly taken on a much more powerful influence on our lives because of the increasing complexity of the world.
And that resentment and anger that people feel as they realize that they are becoming more dependent on experts, that can have some political ramifications, can't it? I mean, if you get politicians who come along who suggest that, you know, experts are looking down on them, that the elite is sort of has a kind of a condescending attitude towards them, that, you know, to the extent that people feel that resentment, politicians have an opening there, can't they? They can exploit that.
Yes, they do. And this is a good point for me to point out that I don't represent the Navy or the government in these comments, in my personal view. I think that the president's campaign exploited that very adeptly in the past year, that Donald Trump is the voice of the average person and that he's going to kind of get even with all these experts, that Hillary Clinton is one of these smart, Ivy-educated policy wonks who's looking down on you. One of the things that I think the politicians have done, and the Trump campaign did especially well, was to fuse the notion of expert to the notion of elite, which I think is wrong. And I point this out in the book that often experts, I was an expert advisor to a senator. I mean, I was, you know, a young guy. I was hardly a member of the elite. But that experts propose and politicians and policymakers dispose. And what a lot of people have gotten into their heads now is experts pretty much run everything, and it's difficult for them to understand that our advice is not always taken. It's not always taken completely or implemented perfectly. And this is probably a good point to say as well, that, you know, we do get things wrong. Experts do make mistakes. We have screwed some things up. But the way that the political environment has used this is to say everything that's gone wrong in your life, whether it's been your own choice or not, or whether it's some larger change in the world that no one can control, this is the fault of some expert somewhere who is in league with the elites. And I think that's extremely corrosive to a democracy like ours.
Do you think the elites themselves bear some responsibility for this? Do you see some patronizing attitudes on the part of the cultural, academic, journalistic, political elite toward the rest of America?
Without question. And I'll step forward and say, I've been part of that problem. I grew up in a working class family, but, you know, over time, you spend a lot of time studying something so deeply that you I think it's easy to lose your empathy. It's easy to remember there was a time where this was all a mystery to you. And I think experts can sometimes lose that. They can be patronizing. They can be condescending. And I think anyone who's an expert in any field who's never done that is probably a saint. With that said, I think it's also exasperating. And I think what you've seen with some of that in the expert community is a certain amount of exasperation. And I've experienced this myself where people say, well, I don't agree with you about Russia, and I don't really understand kind of the basics of any of this. So you find yourself starting right back at first principles, and it becomes tiring to say, well, this is the way the world works. This is how states function. This is the way the economy is structured. And they kind of wave their hand and say, that's just expert mumbo jumbo. And at that point, I think experts kind of throw their hands up and say, all right, fine, we'll just talk to each other instead of talking to you because it's just too difficult. And in the book, I tell experts they have to stop doing this. They really have to reengage with the public, as unpleasant as it can be, and take their lumps and get out there and do their job.
I'm guessing that in your research for this book, you came across, if you hadn't seen it already, that comment by the Nebraska Senator Roman Ruska back in 1970 when he was asked to consider the qualifications of Judge Harold Carswell, to be on the Supreme Court. And Carswell was considered by many in his profession to be unqualified. And Ruska said, even if he were mediocre, there are a lot of mediocre judges and people. They're entitled to a little representation, aren't they? Kind of a forerunner of what you're talking to, this idea that sort of that what's wrong with having mediocre people?
People will say that, but they never want it to be the expert that they want working on their issues. No one gets on a plane and says, hey, you know, not everybody grows up to be an astronaut. If the pilot of this plane was the guy at the bottom of his class, that's fine. You know, if the person taking out my appendix was, you know, the last guy who slid into medical school, well, I'm going to strike a blow for the average person. People always want the best they can find. And we are a meritocratic society. We used to celebrate excellence. And so this notion that, you know, even the mediocre deserve a voice is something people say, but something they always want somebody else to be the champion of.
Well, speaking of that, Tom, interesting Gallup poll, which I'm sure you're familiar with it. We've seen it before. And that's the perennial Gallup poll on confidence in U.S. institutions. And what it does show is that Americans don't view all experts with equal disdain. The military still gets a great deal or quite a lot of support. 72% of Americans say they have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence. 72% of the American people say they have either a great deal or quite a lot of support for the U.S. military. Then you go all the way down to the banks and public schools, and wow, my printout here doesn't even go low enough to get the journalists in there. Americans see these various institutions differently, don't they?
Yes, and you know, part of the problem is that a lot of the expertise that makes this very advanced, remarkable world around us function is invisible to the average person. And so because it's invisible to them, again, in an earlier time, I think people understood there's a lot of, you know, smart people who make things happen that's invisible to them, but they know it's there. I think today we've become such an advanced society that people look around and they say, hey, everything works. How hard can this be? I always take my students through, when I'm trying to explain how interconnected the world is, I always take my students through the steps it takes to mail a letter. Well, now, of course, you know, in the age of email, students kind of shrug their shoulders, but say, look, you know, to send a package, you go to the post office, you drop that in a slot, and 3 or 4 days later, it shows up in Brazil or Kazakhstan or Paris or wherever you sent it, and you simply take that for granted, when in fact, that's really a remarkable thing. And I try to get people to understand every time you turn your faucet on and perfectly clean water comes out of it, that's kind of a miracle. And a lot of people had to get a lot of things right, not just scientists and engineers, but politicians and community leaders and others to make it so that, you know, roads actually exist and bridges don't fall down and water comes out. Now, of course, people say, well, there's dirty water, there are bridges that do fall down. But they're so remarkable that we actually consider those the exception. And I think people they have a lot of faith in the military because that's visible competence. The other group you'd see when people don't argue with experts, the only other community they won't argue with are places where that's visible, like sports. Nobody says, hey, you know, I could be a 300 hitter, because it's demonstrable to them that they can't be. But on a lot of other work, especially anything that requires intelligence or intellectual ability, people say, teaching, that's not hard. You stand up and talk. Or being a journalist, you just write stuff, and whether it's true or not. And I think people really don't understand how hard all of these jobs are.
Well, I can tell you that being a journalist is really challenging, Tom. but actually, you know, it's interesting that we journalists are held in such low esteem, because one of our functions is to mediate between the experts and the public. I mean, you know, you point out that people can't be expected to understand the complexity of everything. I think one of our responsibilities as journalists is to try to understand as much as we can, and then to sort of communicate it to a broader audience. And yet, you know, the trust in our ability to do that seems to be very low.
Well, there's a couple of reasons journalists are held in low esteem. And some of it, just as with any other expert community, some of it journalists have brought on themselves. I mean, there is, as the media has segmented into these kind of stovepipes of, you know, Fox News, MSNBC, HuffPost, Slate, whatever it is, there is more spin, there is more bias, there is more attitude in the journalism that people find somewhat off-putting. Although I would say the people are also getting exactly what they want, because that's very market-driven. But the other problem, and one journalist can't solve, no expert can solve, one reason people don't like journalists is because it's your job to tell them things they don't want to hear. And you're not there to tell them things that make them happy. You're there to tell them things that are true. Every expert who steps forward and does that is in for a blast from the public, a serious amount of wrath from the public. But I argue that that's an expert's job, because our client, whether you're a professor or a journalist or a military officer, our client is society. And we have to step forward and tell them the things they don't want to hear. And that makes them very angry. And it makes them, you know, we've become very intolerant of hearing things. I would say we've even become almost childlike about not hearing things we don't want to hear. But that's our job as experts, and it makes us unpopular sometimes.
How much does this loss of faith and expertise jeopardize democracy?
I think especially in a representative democracy like ours, it's an immense danger. The founders of the American system were anti-populist. They were not fond of the notion of running things by plebiscite. They specifically eschewed a unified system of powers and a parliamentary democracy. They divided government so that it would be weak and slow and thoughtful and careful to react. And when people dismiss expert opinion, what they're really saying is to short circuit the entire American system and simply do everything by plebiscite, to do things the way the British did it during Brexit. Well, as we can see, the British woke up the next morning all looking at each other saying, wow, not sure we really wanted to do that. Certainly not by, you know, 51% and change. The United States is not that kind of system. And I think it's dangerous to us. It's also dangerous to other democracies, because populism, and maybe this is just because I'm conservative by temperament, I think populism is extremely dangerous, because it is uninformed, and it does search for short-term answers at the expense of long-term health of a republic. So I think all of this dismissal of expertise, and again, let me be clear, not the questioning or skepticism about expertise, but the outright dismissal of expertise and hostility to expertise is really a serious danger to the health of the American Republic.
You know, every time there's an election, responsible news organizations put a lot of effort into kind of laying out the narrow policy differences between the candidates on a number of issues. So you can go on a candidate's website and see detailed prescriptions of how they would reform the healthcare system, et cetera. As the challenge of governing becomes so much more complex, how are citizens able to make intelligent choices? How can they sort through, you know, all these various and sophisticated policy positions that, you know, that are incomprehensible to even to a lot of people who make them?
Well, in the book, I recommend a division of labor here. I think public intellectuals, along with journalists, are the mediators here. Public intellectuals, and there used to be a lot more of them, they've stepped back from public life, I think, and they've been replaced by pundits who are quite different from public intellectuals. Public intellectuals used to be the people that can simplify and explain complicated matters to the public. And I think they need to make a return to the public sphere and do what they can to elbow aside at least some of the noise. But the public, in the end, as I say in the book, there's only one group of people who can solve this, and this is the voters of the United States of America. The same people who claim that they don't have the time to read one newspaper a day will spend hours watching reality television or sports events or just kind of waste time sitting on the couch watching endless amounts of nonsense. And everybody has an excuse for it. When people say to me, well, you know, give me your advice for being better informed, they say, well, start with one national newspaper a day. And they say, well, I won't read the New York Times because it's biased. And I say, fine, read the Wall Street Journal. And they say, well, I'm not going to read that because it's the voice of capitalism. And I say, okay, try the Washington Post. And they say, well, that's the foreign policy establishment. What you really get to is that by the end of the conversation, what they're really saying is, look, I don't want to read any of this stuff. I just want to find things that already confirm and affirm and empower me in what I already believe. And there, you know, if people aren't going to get out there and embrace sources of information that challenge them and make them think and just keep up on basics, on things like, you know, not just what is our policy in Syria, but things like where is Syria, then there's simply no hope for having this conversation, because I think we've lost so much foundational knowledge that's easily gained if people will just take a few minutes out of their day. And you don't have to be a college graduate. You don't have to be the smartest guy in the world. You just have to be willing to read a newspaper. But if you're not willing to do that, I think we're in deep trouble indeed.
Well, I hope that you are able to spread that message far and wide, because I think you're raising a really crucial issue for the future of American democracy.
Thank you. I wrote the book hoping that it would spur this kind of discussion, and I hope we can have this kind of a debate and get people more reengaged before we face something terrible, before we have to reengage out of necessity in the face of a major conflict or a pandemic or something along those lines. So hopefully it'll happen before then.
The book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters by Tom Nichols. Tom, great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And for this week from the archives, in our first segment, Diane generously plugged my book, Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. It's a history of Cuba told around the life of the Bacardi rum family. The Bacardis were at the center of so much that happened in Cuba through the 19th and 20th centuries. As I told Diane when we spoke about the book back in 2008, here's a clip from that conversation.
This is quite a story. This Bacardi family goes back 150 years.
It goes back to the middle of the 19th century, Diane, and which is happens to be the period when Cuban nationalism was really taking root, when there was really first a movement to define the Cuban nationality and to establish a free and independent Cuba. And the Bacardis were involved in that effort from the ground up. And they also, because they made rum, their enterprise sort of grew directly out of the whole sugar culture in Cuba, which is so key to the country's history as well.
And what about the Bacardi's family relationship to the governing country of Spain at the time?
Well, interestingly, Facundo Bacardi, the patriarch of the family, was an immigrant from Spain. And he actually belonged to a group of Spanish immigrants in Cuba who sort of promoted the connection with the motherland, which is what makes the family's patriotism more interesting, because it was his sons, and first of all, Emilio Bacardi, his oldest son, who really became the Cuban patriot in spite of his father's attachment to the motherland. Now, Facundo Bacardi came from the part of Spain, Catalonia, which had always had its own issues with Madrid. And so Facundo had a little bit of sympathy for those who sort of resented the controlling aspect of Spanish rule. Nevertheless, he was in general pro-Spain, and the company, the Bacardi Rum Company that he founded, for many, many years emphasized its relation with Spain, even as the Bacardi sons were conspiring against it.
You can listen to that entire show on dianereem.org. So that's our show for this week. Let us know what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. Or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music was produced by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capital Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Gelton of NPR News.